Race matters.
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 I'd like to acknowledge that we are broadcasting on unceded Gadigal land. This land has been in the hands of generations of Gadigal custodians for thousands of years before us, and it will continue to be in their hands long after us. It's a meeting place for sharing knowledge, stories, and song. And we are privileged to be part of that storytelling today and every day at FBI Radio. I pay my respects to Gadigal elders, past and present. We're broadcasting from Redfern right now, the birthplace of Black theatre in this country, and a site for resistance and resilience for First Nations peoples. We honour this in all the work we do and carry this into our conversation today.
A commitment to protest and a deep sensitivity to loving action is what guides our chat today. My name is Tubes and I'm here with Samantha Haran. We're bringing you a dialogue between two First Nations artists and activists, Thea Annamara Perkins and Jazz Money. Their works grapple with ideas of reclaiming colonial archives and resisting through poetic and lush art making. Their creative practices are testaments to a politics of care and a staunch resistance to settler violence.
You've heard him across the airwaves on Monday Lunch. Today, we're excited to have Lavon Jankaya join Race Matters, bringing you this reflective chat. Alongside his work on FBI Radio, Lavant is a curator and writer working from Wallumattagal Noora. He delved into these ideas with Jazz and Theo.
My name is Lavant Jankaya. I'm a curator and writer working from Wallumattagal Noora. Thea Annamara Perkins and Jazz Money join us on Race Matters, two staunch First Nations artists who have creative practices holding a commitment to protest and a deep sensitivity to loving action. Jazz Money is a Wiradjuri and Irish artist, poet, and filmmaker. Their practice looks to poetics and moving images as a continuation of the oral tradition of First Nations storytelling on and for this continent. Care, love, and protest emanate off of Jazz's multidisciplinary artworks, which can be as momentous as an immersive site-specific installation or as intimate as a poem on a page. Thea Annamara Perkins is a Arunda and Kalkadoon painter of portraiture and landscape. She depicts rich and cinematic glimmers of family archives, the central Australian landscape, and moments of First Nations activism with an expressive and emotive brush. As the great-granddaughter of Arunda elder Hetty Perkins, granddaughter of activist Charles Perkins, and daughter of curator Hetty Perkins, her practice continues and pays homage to a lineage of steadfast First Nations world builders. A point your practices converge is in the exploration of personal archives. Thea, your practice does this very materially by using deeply sentimental family photographs as subjects of your lush and expressive paintings. Jazz, your recent commission by the Australian Centre for Contemporary Art, Infinite Iterative Poem, sees your personal archive of writing spliced and randomly overlaid on these sublime and ethereal videos. To the both of you, do you ever feel vulnerable offering these pieces of your personal archives to the eyes of the public? Maybe, Jazz, we can start with you.
I think as someone who writes poetry, which is such an inherently personal medium, I had to make peace with that a long time ago that, you know, poetry is very much a process of sort of splitting your ribcage open and passing over your guts to an audience and saying, like, well, what do you think of this? So it sort of makes sense to me to continue that logic into an art-making practice, but I find it to be a bit a bit harder in a sort of visual arts medium. I think working with poetry the way that I do in a visual arts way is sort of so inherently personal that then to draw in my own personal archive again, I don't know, it sometimes that feels like it's actually obfuscating the fact of the matter, which is kind of nice. You know, I get to sort of like gesture towards the truth without ever needing to be explicit about it, which, for me is kind of, it feels almost like the laziest way I could make work. I'm like, well, this is just about me this time, because so much of the work that I typically make in visual art is so research heavy about other things that then when I'm drawing on my own archive, I'm like, oh, you can't really get it wrong, which is a lovely feeling as well.
And what about you, Thea?
My practice is an incredibly vulnerable thing, and I do feel that sense of exposure, but it also has this beautiful effect, flow-on effect of communicating really well and in kind of intangible way.
Something that I love so much about your practice is it feels so truthful, like because you're drawing on something that is so personal and so intimate, like the relationship, like as First Nations people, I feel like so often the colony tries to tell our story on our behalf, and your practice like feels like such a like intervention into that, like this is my family story told by my family.
Delving into my family archives and then sharing a really kind of raw process with the world is a very vulnerable thing to do, and I definitely do feel that exposure. And I've actually had people approach me and say, like, oh, in some cases being like, oh, I actually don't feel like I should be seeing these images because they're so personal. But I think sharing something that's intimate is actually a really effective a way of communicating, because it does really resonate with people and have that effect. And it's about what is sharing what I know and what's my own experience and the truth of that, which I think is a very powerful thing.
How do you deploy personal archives to commentate on a broader political context?
I've been thinking about this a lot lately in terms of the way that we speak about the fullness of a First Nations experience in a space where our story has so often been taken away from us and has been rendered to suit a colonial myth in a myth-making project in defining this nation. And I see that a lot in the deficit model and in the deficit way that our story is told, where First Nations people are so often rendered less than, you know, where so when you see images of us in public spaces or on the media, it's so often to talk about violences and crimes that are happening to our bodies or to our countries. And it's devastating, and I think it creates this notion in a sort of public space that First Nations people are less in some way, and that's devastating. And to me, I've been really focusing a lot lately on also celebrating our joy and our love and our strength and our beauty and our sexiness. And so these things that are so often rendered out of our story when the story is not being told by us. And the violence of colonization is a very recent history in the First Nations experience. We've lived on this continent for millennia. We've lived here since the first sunrise. And I don't mean to like advocate for a sort of naivety and sort of overlook the colonial history and the recent violence, because it is tremendously huge. But we also need to say, like, we honour our ancestors by laughing and by dancing and by singing and by gathering as well. You know, we honour them in our fight, but we also honour them in our joy. And to me, that's what sort of bringing in the personal is so and so powerful, because my experience as a First Nations queer person is one that is defined by beauty. And I feel like celebrating that is actually this really powerful act of protest. And it's this really powerful act of reclaiming the story and saying, like, you don't get to write it on our behalf. We tell the story of this place. And that's what I want to sort of model for younger folk as well, because I feel like that was something I really needed when I was younger.
And I love the way you're speaking to Joy. And I think I see a connection there also with Thea's practice when, Thea, I've seen you refer to this idea of the glimmer in your paintings. And I love that notion because it really evokes tenderness and bliss and nostalgia. And I'd love to know why you ground your work in that notion of the glimmer.
Yeah, well, I think that the idea of the glimmer, you know, it's something that I came across while I was making works. And often when I am making, I'll be driven by compulsion, and it is through the process that more kind of abstract ideas kind of yield themselves. And I came across this term, glimmer, which is used in psychology, and it's the opposite of a trigger point. So it connotes safety and belonging. And I think for me, when I wanted to paint these images of my family, you know, growing up, I just saw so much misinformation and, you know, misrepresentation. And, you know, it really was something that I wanted to address. And so, you know, using my personal archives, I think, was really powerful because it's, you know, it's what I know. And it's the way that the kind of personal can then speak to something more universal. What we all know about our families as being, you know, these strong, resilient, loving things. So the glimmer really was a beautiful way of encapsulating what I was trying to say with those works.
It's a beautiful notion, and particularly in relation to your family that has such a rich legacy of protest and activism in so-called Australia. And your recent work and exhibition at Cement Fondue is very much a continuation of that legacy. Could you tell us a little bit about that exhibition?
So these works are all joined by a climate consciousness, I think, and especially the, you know, unique way that the climate is impacted in central Australia. So we've got a lot of threat on water and fracking, and also things like skyrocketing temperatures. So these works were about addressing those concerns, but also with a really big focus on voice. So it includes landscapes and a series of posters I did, which for the posters I worked with town camps around Alice Springs or in Bantwa. The landscape works, because they're all centered around the telegraph station in Alice Springs, which is where my grandfather was born and where he rests, and it was the site of the half-caste institution in Alice Springs, as it was called. But for me, it's such a kind of nexus for my connection to that place. And the landscapes in that show are all, in a way, contain my anxieties about climate and also my love for that place.
Jazz, you know, the spirit of social justice is so salient in your poetic and artistic work as well. Beyond your practice, you've also been really outspoken about your solidarity with Palestine in light of the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Have you had any tensions arise because of working with this subject matter?
Yes. I shouldn't laugh, but like, it's like laugh or cry at this point, right? I'm so disappointed in the arts and creative industries broadly. The silence and therefore sort of complicity in Australia's role in this genocide. And I guess for me, it has just highlighted how tokenistic the acknowledgement of country, the raps, all these sort of gestures that arts orgs make across Australia, so-called Australia, towards First Nations justice, and how little it translates into a moment where meaningful change could actually be realised. To me, it makes so apparent, I think, that these arts organisations see our politics as profitable, and they see our politics as an aesthetic that they can market without actually having any meaningful engagement with what decolonization, with what solidarity, with what land back actually means. And I don't think it is overblown to draw parallels between what's happening in Gaza and what has happened on this continent. I think there's been 76 years of Nakba in Palestine. There's been 232 years of invasion here, and they follow very, very similar paths. And I think globally, to be watching a genocide in real time from all our devices, to me, it is shocking that in a space like the creative arts, which prides itself on a certain politic and a certain progressiveness, that we see so much silence, or we hear so much silence, and we see so little action from people who so quickly will rise up and talk about other causes. So yeah, I am outspoken about it, and it has affected my work. I've lost a lot of work. It's been really, really, really frustrating. And having these conversations sort of weekly about why I'm losing work, and people saying why they won't work with me anymore. But also saying, you know, quietly to me, we agree with you, but we can't have you saying this publicly. And it's like, well, then you don't agree with me. Then we're fundamentally opposed, because if you're not talking about this, we are approaching this very, very differently.
Mm. And how do you both, as practicing artists, navigate that tension there, working with institutions that might have historically harmed marginalized communities?
Yeah, I mean, that's so much of the legacy of working in a place like this, right? Like, all the institutions that we engage with basically have dark legacies, or levels of complicity in the mistreatment of First Nations communities, the theft of land, the theft of resources, the desecration of sacred land. But I don't think we address any of these problems by trying to ignore them, or by trying to put them on the shelf and say it didn't happen. And sort of to come back to the conversation about archives, I've been working a lot with the National Film and Sound Archive in Canberra over the last 2 years on a film I made with them called Wanangana. And that was a process of going through the audiovisual archives that stretch back to the sort of the beginning of that medium coming to this continent. And there's a lot of violence. There's a lot of violence that exists in the visual and audio records. But we can't address that. We can't speak about it. We can't do anything with it if we ignore it, right? I think we need to recognize that we live in an active colony, and that we can only begin to redress some of the harm that has taken place here by naming it and by calling it what it is. So that's sort of the process through which I make my art, through which I make my poetry. It's informed from a place of like a very real political position and a very real activism, but trying to draw people in to have a more nuanced, more complex and more rigorous sort of conversation, to not treat things as surface or shallow, but actually to say, like, there is a great deal of depth. Every footstep that you take on this continent connects you to stories that go back to the very beginning. And I think there is so much strength that we can draw on when we are led by our ancestors in how we are going to move forward together.
There can be this misconception, because there have been, you know, there have been gains in recent years, but it's often a case of, like, you know, one step forward, two steps back, I think. And it is a constant process, basically. And I think in my work, a lot of what I consider I do is approach things in a philosophical way, and trying to break down all of these shifting, moving paradigms, and, you know, trying to get towards the truth, and truth-telling is a really difficult process. But especially in my family, a great thing that has always, you know, been impressed on us is that you can also do it your way, you know, and you can do advocacy as it's right for you. And I think for me, you know, leading with love, and I'm a gentle person naturally, so leading with that is how I try and kind of gently, you know, make my way through really tricky territory.
On the show today, we've been listening to a conversation between Lavant Jankaya and artists Thea and Amara Perkins and Jazz Money. Let's get back to Lev, Thea, and Jazz as they chat about collective imagination.
Thea, you've had four portraits that were acquired by the Art Gallery of New South Wales after you received the La Prairie Award last year. And I noticed a lot of reference to this idea of the portraits and their depiction of love and strength in First Nations families becoming a part of the collective imagination. Could you perhaps expand upon what you mean there by the collective imagination and what the importance of having those portraits be a part of it is?
Yeah, so I was very fortunate growing up that I got to see a lot of art, you know, from Central Australia and on the East Coast. And, you know, they're quite disparate languages, I guess, in some ways, although there's lots of crossovers, but especially kind of looking at, say, the old courts and, say, these kind of classic paintings by old masters, you know, problematic as they are, they've had these kind of enduring appeal, and I was interested in how I could kind of take what I wanted to say and what I wanted to, and take charge of representation, but use it in a language that could, you know, enter into this collective imagination, I guess. And for me, that was taking that Western vernacular and then infusing it with all of the colours and vibrancy and love.
Imagination is also rooted in so much of your poetic work. I'm particularly thinking about something I read where you were speaking to creating the rhythm of Wiradjuri in English through your poetry. I'd love to know, you know, when talking about this amid the ongoing violence experienced by colonised people, what role does imagination play in our desires for freedom and expression?
I love that, because I think it is such a part of it. You know, we are not yet living in a world where we see ourselves all as equal, and we have to be able to imagine it if we're going to achieve it, right? I very much am of a burn it down philosophy, but I think we need to know, or we need to have imagined, or we need to have a hope for what comes after we burn it down. I think if we burn it down without an idea of what grows next, we're kind of not going anywhere, right? And, you know, this is something we know from First Nations ways of being with country, is you plant and you care and you grow over time, and you have a very, very multi-generational approach to time and to deep time. And I think, you know, all the tools that we need have been laid out many, many times before us, and we need to be able to see them in our future as well as in our past. And yeah, this idea of a collective imagining is, I think, a very motivating factor, right? I think it gives us something to be working towards, rather than, it's very easy at the moment to look around and just despair. And despair is not an option.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful way of creating and instilling this idea of all of the beautiful things that we have and what we're taking going forward, and how we imagine that. And that's, yeah, a super powerful thing, and a really important and beautiful practice, I think.
Really, really generous offerings from Lev, Thea, and Jazz. I think I'm really reflecting on the importance of that collective imagination, especially at the moment. We're looking at all the university encampments pop up across the globe in response to standing in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle. And I think that it's just so important, as Jazz said, that, you know, we're all for burning it all down. But I think it's important to have that ability to imagine what next. And, you know, you can see that in little pockets happening, you know, around in community, or like elements of mutual aid coming in to really offer an alternate antidote to, you know, the bloodshed, the bloodstained sandstone of institutions such as Sydney Uni or, yeah, other institutions around.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that what we're seeing is that in the ecology of the fight for a free Palestine and the fight for making a better world in general, everybody has a role to play. And it's been incredible to see students across the globe answer that call. And I think the conversation that we listened to today with artists Thea and Jazz reminded me about how Tony K. Pambara said that the role of the artist is to make the revolution irresistible. And I think that's very much what Jazz and Thea are speaking to today and doing with their practice. And it was such an honor to hear them delve into these ideas with Lev.
That's all for Race Matters this week. I'm Tubes.
And I'm Samantha Haran. Thank you to Lev, Thea, and Jazz for the incredible conversation. It has left us with so many seeds to think about.
You can listen back to episodes of Race Matters at fbiradio.com/racematters, across the Community Radio Network, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Race Matters.
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 Race Matters.